Good morning. We have an excellent crowd that has assembled today. Good to see cousin, his family. Good to see all those that are out, our visitors that are with us. Very beautiful Lord's Day that we've been given. We're very thankful for the opportunity to stand before you this morning. This morning I have a lesson entitled Teaching Old Testament Stories. And so there's some little bit of background behind this. A lot of it has to do with, of course, we've had Nathan Batty in recent times. And I had some questions for him. And so I asked him a few things about, because I think we kind of think similar, Nathan and I, about the way you can look at something in the Old Testament and it can expand into the New Testament. But I've always had some issues with that. I wanted to make sure that I was doing it the right way, that I wasn't giving, where I wasn't assigning meaning to something that really didn't deserve it. So I asked him some questions. And it was about 2 weeks after that, got home one day and there was a package from the mail. He had mailed me about four books that kind of talked about some of this. So I'm going to share some of that information I've learned from these books and from talking with Nathan. I want to start this lesson, though, with Psalm 136. If you want to turn in your Bibles to Psalm 136. Mine has a footnote at the top. It says, Thanksgiving to God for His enduring mercy. So it doesn't say who it's written, if it's a Psalm of David. So we're just going to say the Psalms. Now in Psalm 136, up here I took out part of it, because if not, it'll take me a long, long time to read it. Because if you see up here in bold where it says, for His mercy endures forever, that is repeated about 20 times. And what this was a psalm, it was kind of a back and forth. That the priest, I suppose, or whoever, would begin, and he would read one part, and then the congregation would sing back, for His mercy endures forever. And then he would read the next part, or sing the next part. And then the congregation would respond, for His mercy endures forever. So to make this go a little smoother, I just kind of put it into sections. I took out a whole bunch of the, for His mercy endures forever, because if not, we kind of get fixated upon that and miss the story. Now remember, this is a song. This is a song that the nation of Israel would sing. It goes something like this. I wish I knew the rhythm to it. I wish I knew the music to it. I wish I knew if it was a song or more of a chant. I don't know. But imagine this being a song that you're hearing in your mind. Oh, give thanks to the Lord, for He is good, for His mercy endures forever. Oh, give thanks to the God of gods. Oh, give thanks to the Lord of lords. To Him who alone does great wonders. To Him who by wisdom made the heavens. To Him who laid out the earth above the waters. To Him who made great lights, the sun to rule by day, the moon and stars to rule by night, for His mercy endures forever. To Him who struck Egypt in their firstborn, and brought out Israel from among them, with a strong hand and with an outstretched arm. To Him who divided the Red Sea in two, and made Israel pass through the midst of it, but overthrew Pharaoh and his army in the Red Sea, for His mercy endures forever. To Him who led His people through the wilderness, to Him who struck down great kings, and slew famous kings, Sihon, king of the Amorites, and Og, king of Bashan, and gave their land as a heritage to Israel His servant, for His mercy endures forever. Who remembered us in our lowly state, and rescued us from our enemies, who gives food to all flesh, O give thanks to the God of heaven, for His mercy endures forever. There are several psalms that are written in this same format, where it goes back and it recounts historical events, historical stories that were told in the Old Testament that the people were supposed to know. And that's what we're going to talk about this morning, teaching Old Testament stories. You know, a lot of times, even in the church, people don't know how to deal with the Old Testament. Do we teach it? Do we not teach it? Is it just something that's not important to us as Christians because we are on the New Testament side of things? Do we really need to worry about the Old Testament? And I think the Old Testament is very important. And I'm very impressed with the teachings that we have done recently in this congregation. Our whole study through the book of Hebrews and trying to tie together the Old Covenant to the New. This month, looking at Psalm 69 and how it is found throughout the New Testament again and again by all the writers. It's so important. I think a lot of people get kind of tied up in the Old Testament. Some people treat it just like a storybook. And on one hand, that's fine. You know, Drew has several times in his story, in his sermons, mentioned, I remember this story from the book that we used to have, this Bible storybook that we read when we were kids. And so that's important that we teach the stories and the kids understand it. But there's so much more to that. I can't tell you how many times I read that story to Aaron about Rebecca and they until the camels were no longer thirsty. That was the line of that book, and I've read that 100 times. It's important that we teach Old Testament stories, but there's so much more meaning to them than just as a childhood storybook. And that's what I want to look at this morning. How much of these Old Testament stories did you pick up on? Do you know the story of Sihon and Og? Some of us might, some of us might not. Do you know the story about striking Egypt and their firstborn? Probably. That's a story of the Passover. Did you pick up on the Red Sea being divided into two? Absolutely. That's a pretty common story, the story of the Exodus. But as we start looking at these songs, these historical songs, I'm going to pull out some stuff that I bet we don't know. That we really don't have a good understanding. We may have a surface understanding, but we really don't understand why it is so important that the psalmist decided to include it. This was the song they sang over and over and over. They were supposed to know this stuff and know the meaning of it and know the story behind it so they could build upon it and learn from the examples that were given in the past. So that's what we'll look at a little while this morning. We're going to talk about some Old Testament stories and how to teach them. And I'm going to tell you several stories. So from the youngest, you're going to be able to hear some Bible stories. But it's going to be a pretty deep lesson too, especially for teachers. What do we do and how do we teach the Old Testament stories? Before we go further, though, let's go to God in a word. Well, I have identified Psalm 136. I call it a historical psalm. Now, that's not a biblical term. Google it. Some people call this historical. You may see different names for it. But I have picked up on several. What they are. They're just psalms that recount the history of the nation of Israel. So for lack of a better term, I just entitled them the historical psalms. I have three questions we need to talk about. Number one, how were psalms named? Have you ever thought about this? How were psalms named? Did they call it the 23rd psalm? Well, the answer is no. That's not how the Jews would have referred to the psalms. That's what we call it, because we have them written down like this, but that's not how they were referred to. Typically, they were referred to by the first line, or maybe the most important line that was repeated. And so, my God, why has thou forsaken me? That was the name of a psalm. We call it, you know, Psalm 22, but that was the name of a psalm. That's how they would recognize it, by the first line or maybe a repeating line. I'm going to guess Psalm 136, when the Jews were talking about it, they probably called it, "For His mercy endures forever," if I was guessing, since it was repeated about 25 times in that psalm. So the psalms were named differently. So don't get caught up on the numbers of the psalms. That is not how the Jews named their psalms. Number two, what are the historical psalms? It's just psalms that tell a history. And they use historical facts and stories to teach a point, to teach a story. And I have counted about 6 of them. Now some people say there's 5, some people say there's 7. There's not a hard number, but I'll show you the ones that I have found. And the number three question, what is the great Hallel? Well, you probably recognize this word right here. Looks real, real similar to another word that we use in English. It's hallelujah. Hallel means praise. And so the great praise was assigned to Psalm 136. That's what they call it. The Hallels were certain psalms that the Jews sang at certain times, at certain festivals, at certain feasts. Psalm 136, what we read this morning for our text, was what was sung after the Passover, traditionally speaking. So if you think about this verse in Matthew 26 and 30, and when they had sung a hymn, they went out to the Mount of Olives. This was the Lord's Supper. I can't tell you this for a fact. Pretty good chance that it was Psalm 136 that they sang, that was part of the Hallel, the great Hallel that the Jews sang at the time of Passover. So now imagine that song we just sang and how we had one person that kept repeating, "For His mercy endures forever," and then the congregation would repeat it back. Or maybe the congregation would sing that part, and now Jesus would say, "For His mercy endures forever." Think about that. When you think about that, that's Jesus singing that song. Puts a whole lot more meaning into Psalm 136. So here are the historical psalms that I have found. I know Terry's a note taker. You don't have to write it. I've got some notes in the back in a blue folder. I'm about to bring up some charts that I made. So if you want to copy these notes, feel free to get them, pick them up. If I run out, I'll make you some more. But I picked these six psalms as historical psalms. And there may be more, and some people don't consider all of these historical. But Psalm 78, Psalm 83, Psalm 105, Psalm 106, Psalm 135, and what we heard in our reading today, Psalm 136. Each of these psalms refer to specific events in the history of God's people. And these stories are meant to be helped to help teach us and to prove points and to remind people of certain truths and certain things that they were to know. So what happens if you were a Jew and you picked up the psalm and it's talking about Sihon and Og and you don't know who Sihon and Og are? Well, you're not going to be able to get the full benefit of the instruction. So it's very important that these events were known and understood. So I kind of made you a chart here. These are the six that I pulled out that I've called historical psalms. And there's some other things. I just kind of picked the big ones. And I just went through and looked at what was mentioned and what was referenced. And so as you look at each one of these, some of these names and some of these words might sound pretty familiar, and some may not. But the psalmist, when they were writing these songs, and remember, you do a song because it helps you to remember, right? Isn't that how we teach kids to learn their ABCs? They sing the song. The little guys in preschool, I remember, they learned the days of the week. And they put it to the song of the Addams Family. And that's how they learned days of the week. And so they memorized that. So songs are meant to help you memorize. So they started bringing all of these things, these events, these Old Testament stories. And some of them get repeated over and over and over. How many times do you see the word Red Sea up there? It's important. The Red Sea crossing was very, very important. And we need to understand that concept because it was used as a teaching point. The plagues, the 10 plagues that were sent to Egypt, very, very important because they had a very deep spiritual meaning. Gideon, remember Meribah? That's where Moses got in trouble with the rock and the water. So there's all sorts of Old Testament stories. There's my Sihon and Og again, it's mentioned twice. There's Aaron and his golden calf. There's all sorts of biblical stories that were used as teaching points, and we need to understand them. I also made this little chart here. I got to thinking, it's really important, I think, that we understand where things fall in the Old Testament. We start talking about stories. And I made up these categories and these divisions. This is nothing, you know, that we find in the Scriptures. This is just my way of thinking. We've got creation, and that kind of goes the first 11 chapters of Genesis. Then we start talking about the patriarchs. So sometimes our stories fall within the stories of Abraham, to Isaac, to Jacob, all the way down to Joseph. But by the time we start talking about Joseph, now we're getting into Egypt. And we talk about all the things that happened to Joseph, and then the slavery, 400 years, and then we have the Exodus. Once we have the Exodus, there's all sorts of things that happen in the wilderness wanderings. This is when Moses becomes the lead character. From the Red Sea crossing all the way to Joshua, who leads them into the land of Canaan. And from the land of Canaan, we have all these, the Jordan River crossing and taking over the land until we reach Samuel, who was the last of the judges. And now we come to the kingdom. So we talk about Saul, we talk about David, we talk about Solomon. And then something terrible happens after the death of Solomon, the kingdom splits. And then the rest of the Old Testament is pretty much describing the fall of the kingdom. First, the fall of Israel. Then the fall of Judah. All the way to the captivity in Babylon. And then the rest of the Old Testament pretty much is talking about the restoration of the nation of Israel as they return from Babylon. And that takes us all the way to the time of Jesus. So I put that out there just to think, when we talk about these biblical Old Testament stories, where do they fall on our timeline? Because it's important. And it gives substance to it. Instead of it just being a childhood Bible story. That being said, let's talk about teaching Old Testament stories. Did Jesus use Old Testament stories in his teaching? Did the New Testament writers use Old Testament stories in their teaching? Should we use Old Testament stories in our teaching today? Yes? Yes. And it's, I don't think there's any, we shouldn't teach different than Jesus and the apostles did. And if they used Old Testament stories, I think we should as well. But I think we need to do it in the proper way and make sure we understand the Old Testament like it should. So this is where I came up to Nathan Vann. I said, Nathan, I got a question on this. I was working on something. I was talking about the purification process if you had leprosy and you were cured of leprosy. And so there's a whole bunch of symbols. I'm like, Nathan, this is really cool. I think it has to, there's a lot of tie-ins with the crucifixion. But how do I know if I'm assigning meaning to something that doesn't deserve it? So I want to be real, real careful of that. And so that's where Nathan sent me this book. The book is written by a man by the name of Christopher Wright. He called it How to Preach and Teach the Old Testament for All Its Worth. It's a very good little book. And he had seven dangers of teaching Old Testament stories. I've condensed it to four. So we're going to talk about these four this morning. I'll give you an example of each one of these. And these are things that I think we've probably all done. So I want to make a disclaimer. Before we start talking about moralizing the Old Testament, allegorizing, generalizing, and personalizing, and don't worry, I'll tell you what all of these mean. It's not as complicated as what it might look. It's how we approach Old Testament stories. Here's my disclaimer. I'm not criticizing anyone's sermons. I personally have used these four things, and it's just something to think about. So we want to use the Old Testament stories in the most effective way possible. I'm not criticizing the way anyone has used Old Testament stories. I just want us to think a little bit broader and maybe a little bit more outside the box. Number one, moralizing. We moralize Old Testament stories. What I mean by that is there's a danger that we condense the entire story into a short moral of the story that takes it out of its context and takes away its meaning and minimizes what the story is about. Moralizing Old Testament stories. Here's the tricky part. The moral of the story might be spot on. It might be perfect, but it's not the author's intended purpose for it to have a moral of the story. And we need to be careful of that. Let me give you an example. I'm going to tell you the story of Gideon and his 300. That's a pretty common Old Testament story, right? Gideon and the children of Israel, they're in the wilderness. They're about to make their way into the land of Canaan, getting pretty close to it. But here we go. Gideon and his 300, they are fighting. So they've already entered into the promised land, too. They've already entered into the land of Canaan. They are fighting some people called the Midianites. Now, there's always a problem when the Israelites and the Midianites get together. Main reason is they were both descendants of Abraham. Okay? So the Israelites came from Sarah, and the Midianites came from one of Abraham's other wives. But they were kinfolk. And so when the Midianites and the Israelites get together, it's always kind of a weird situation because they were still descendants of Abraham. But these Midianites, let me tell you, they were attacking and really getting after the Israelites. They were coming in. They were taking their food. They were taking their land. The Israelites would have crops. They would have animals. The Midianites would come and take them. And the Israelites were left impoverished. They were so poor. And it got to the point they were either going to have to fight or they were going to die. And so Gideon, as the judge, now he is leading the nation of Israel. And word comes to him and says, you're going to have to fight. And so Gideon calls out all the people and says, we need an army. And 32,000 Israelites respond to the call. And God says to Gideon, that's too many. And so Gideon says, okay, if you don't want to be here, go home. If you don't want to fight, if you got some problems, if you're not 100%, whatever, no questions asked, you can leave. And it says 22,000 of them left. So now we got 10,000 Israelites left, and God says, no, that's way too many. We got to do something else. So they're told to go take a water break. And it says that the people went down, and they all got in their water. And some of the people got down into the water and started going like that. Other people did like this and pulled the water to their hands and licked it up. I don't know why that's important, but God said, that's the ones I want, the ones who did this. And there was 300 of them. And God said, that's the army, Gideon, I want you to take against the Midianites. So Gideon takes his 300 men, and he arms them, just like any army would arm, right, with a trumpet and with a lantern and with some kind of a flask to go over the lantern. I don't know about any weapons, but that's what they took. And so the 300 kind of circled around the Midianites, got late in the night, waited for the signal. They blew the trumpets. They bashed open those the canisters that were holding on top of the torches, and then the torches. And then all of a sudden, it just looked like mass chaos. And the Midianites didn't know what was going on. They didn't know if there was 300 or 3,000 or 300,000. They just saw lights and trumpets and smashing all going around them. And they were scared to death, started attacking themselves. And the Midianites were completely routed by Gideon and his 300. And then we take that story. And don't we actually usually give a moral here? Well, the moral of the story is, few is many with God. And we like to moralize the story. And that's a true statement. It's almost like something you would see on Pinterest, right? God plus one is a majority. It's not the size of the dog in the fight, it's the size of the fight in the dog. That's the kind of morals that we give to the story of Gideon, which is true. But we need to be careful about moralizing the story. Because that's not how the psalmist viewed the situation of Gideon at all. Let me go to one of those other historical psalms. It's Psalm 83. Psalm 83, verses 11 and 12. Make their nobles like Orb and Zeb, yes, all their princes like Zeba and Zalmunna, who said, let us take for ourselves the pastures of God for a possession. Now, I'm not going to ask you to raise your hand, but how many people knew that this was in reference to Gideon? And I would not have raised my hand, but I didn't know that. Because we like to stop at the story of Gideon routing the Midianites, and we moralize it. Few is many when you have God on your side. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. I mean, we'd like to, put a moral of the story. This is what the psalmist said. You got to keep going in the story. You have to keep going to Judges 7:25 and then into Judges chapter 8. What happened was, in the battle, Oreb and Zeb were the nobles of the Midianites. And they captured them. And Oreb and Zeb had their heads chopped off. Then Gideon and his 300 continued pursuing the kings of Midian, Zeba and Zalmunna, and they caught up with them. And so Judges chapter 8, verse 21 talks about how Gideon personally killed those two kings with his own sword. We like to look at the story in terms of Gideon, because it's a great story, it's a cool story. But how did the psalmist look at it? He looked at it in terms of these four men who were fighting against God's people. See, he took a completely different moral than what we did. Let us take for ourselves the pastures of God for a possession. That's what the Midianites were doing to the Israelites. According to the psalmist, that was the important part. But see, when we moralize stories, we have a tendency to overlook things. So Psalm 83 used a different part of the story that we never talk about, because it doesn't fit into our moralization of the story. That's why we've got to be careful of that. Don't pull the story out of its context. Number two, allegorizing. And I have a hard time saying that word, so if I mess it up, I'm sorry. An allegory is basically a parable on steroids. Okay? Parables are usually short and sweet. Allegories are usually much longer, but everything in an allegory has meaning. Parables are usually religious related, religious truths. Allegories may or may not be. A great example, John was talking about George Orwell a minute ago. If you've ever read the book Animal Farm, Animal Farm is an allegory. You think you're reading about farm animals, but come to find out, it's an allegory. The pig represents this, and the chicken represents this, and it's all representing about the dangers of communism. It's an allegory. Sometimes we try to allegorize Old Testament stories. And we assign meaning to every detail in the story, whether it's deserved or not. We got to remember, these are stories. And sometimes details are given just as part of the narrative account. It's just to make the story flow, and they don't have significant meaning. Let me give you an example. The tabernacle. In Exodus chapter 36, that talks about the tabernacle and the colors that were to be used. And I got some study on this. Exodus 36 and 8, that all the gifted artisans among them who worked on the tabernacle made 10 curtains woven of fine linen, of blue, purple, and scarlet thread. And I said to myself, this is where I asked Nathan. I said, why blue, purple, and scarlet? I got some ideas. why blue represents this and purple might represent this and scarlet represents. But I studied and I looked. I can't find anywhere in the scriptures that it explains exactly why blue, purple, and scarlet were to be used. I can't find it. Maybe it's somewhere. I don't know. I couldn't find it. So I had to ask myself, what's the meaning of the colors? I can't find it. I cannot find a biblical definition that says purple means royalty. Now, we say that, but I don't know if that's, I mean, I don't know if that's why it was used in the scriptures or not. I don't know. But we have a tendency to make an allegory where we start assigning meaning to everything. Now, you can Google it. I found two of them. These boys right here, they will tell you exactly what every color means and why there's 10 rings here and why there's 40 rings here, and they give a meaning to every single thing. I don't know if that we ought to do that, because I don't know if we ought to do an allegory. I don't know if we should do an allegory and try to turn everything into meaning if we don't know if it has meaning or not. It might just be that was the most common thread. And that's why they use blue, purple, and scarlet, because that's what they have. We have to be careful of doing an allegory. I know I said Old Testament stories, but I'm going to bring you one from the New Testament. Because we're all pretty familiar with the Good Samaritan story, right? This has stuck in my mind now for 30 years. Some of y'all are not going to believe this. College, 1992, Angelo State. Pretty much three reasons why you went to the library. One is to study, because it's quiet. The other two you're not going to believe. The second reason you go to the library is because that's when the internet had just started. You had to go sign up for a time in the computer lab to get on the internet. So maybe Thursday night from 7 to 7:30, that was my internet time. That's how we got on the internet. We didn't have it at home. You didn't have it on phones. You had to go to the library. Crazy. The third reason, I know none of y'all believe this, sometimes you went to the library to read a book. That's like, nobody does that anymore, but you would go to read a book. And I still remember 30 years ago, I found this book. I believe it was when Terry had done some lessons about the history of the church. And I don't know if my memory's foggy there or not, but that had been about 30 years ago. And I found a book called The Antinician Fathers. And it was a bunch of writings of these early Christians from the 1st, 2nd, 3rd, 4th century. And I came across one. He was talking about the Good Samaritan. And he made an allegory out of it that was unbelievable. So we know the story about how the man's going down and he's attacked by thieves. They leave him for dead on the side of the road. Here comes the priest who walks on the other side. Here comes the Levite who doesn't help him. And then here comes the Samaritan. And the Samaritan does help him and takes care of him and fixes him up and takes him to the inn, gives the innkeeper a little bit of money and says, I'll come back and pay for anything else that you might need. Here's a crazy question. Who's represented by the innkeeper? I don't know. 30 years I remember this. There was a fellow by the name of St. John Chrysostom, and I read his works, and he talked about who the innkeeper was. He allegorized every part of the story. Another guy named Origen, he did the exact same thing. That this guy represented this, and the Levite represented this, and the thieves represented this, and the two denarii represented this, and the innkeeper represented, and he had it allegorized. And I remember thinking, how did he come up with that? Where did that come from? That's not biblical. But that's what happens when we allegorize a statement, and we try to put everything into detail. Is that the purpose of the author's teaching? And I can't say that it is. I can't say that it isn't. But it's not something that we ought to teach because it cheapens the story. By the way, he said it was the Apostle Paul. I thought that was crazy. Number three, generalizing. Where we simplify a story into a platform for doctrinal points. I've done this before. Because it makes a good framework for a lesson. The points might be absolutely true and meaningful, but it minimizes the story. And it takes it out of its larger context and makes it something that is probably not meant to be. My example is David and Goliath. We know the story of David and Goliath, right? David, the ruddy little guy, comes up. He's not scared of Goliath. The rest of the army is. Goliath is coming up, you know, hissing and cussing at him, daring someone to come fight him. And David can't believe that the Israelites are all a bunch of little wimps and won't fight him. So he says, I'll do it. And so he goes down and he picks up 5 smooth stones, puts them in a bag, gets his slingshot ready, and takes off running at that giant and pulls one of those stones out, hits him in the forehead, drops him to the ground. He doesn't have a sword, so he has to go get Goliath's sword and off with his head. And David becomes the hero of Israel that day. I'm going to make you a fake sermon real quick. This is what I mean by generalizing. We take that story. Oh, it's the five stones of defeating Goliath. And then we say something like this. We use this as a text. 1 Samuel 17:40, how he took himself five smooth stones. And David took the stone of courage. And David took the stone of faith. And then we get these points, right? David took the stone of boldness and the stone of preparation and whatever we want to use. And we try to fit that into a framework of a lesson. I'm not saying it's wrong. And I'm not saying that all those points could be made into a very good sermon. But that is not the purpose of the story of David and Goliath. It's to give us a framework to write a lesson. That's what I mean by generalizing. Number four, personalizing. There's a danger that we make everything about us. And we try to find everything in this Old Testament story to relate to our lives. Now we should ask, how does this apply to me? Or how does this apply to God's children? I understand that. But we have to remember the stories are not a personal promise. Because I think this really bothers people sometimes when things don't go the way they think they should. And it causes them to lose faith. My example is the fiery furnace. Remember the story in Daniel? The three Hebrew boys, we don't know, I can't remember their Hebrew names off the top of my head. I know they're Babylonian names. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And Nebuchadnezzar the king makes this big old statue and says, all right, everybody, when you hear the trumpets, everybody has to bow down and worship. And Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego said, we are not going to bow down and worship. And so they blew the trumpet, and everybody bowed down except for Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They were arrested. They were brought before the king. And this is what they said. If that is the case, our God, whom we will serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us from your hand, O king. King said, if you're not going to bow down, I'm going to throw you in this furnace and burn you up. And they said, our God will deliver us. So, what do we say? Is that a promise? Is that a promise now that we can teach the story? If we'll believe in God, God will prevail. God will give us a way of escape. God will take care of us. Well, is that a personal promise? Should we teach that message that God will always deliver us from his own, from out of harm, his own? But we got a problem. What about Moses? Moses as a baby was delivered, right? Remember how Moses' mama put him in the little basket and sent him down the river? Moses was delivered. What about all those thousands, tens of thousands of other babies that were not delivered? Jeremiah was delivered. Jeremiah the prophet was delivered. God took care of him. What about Uriah? Okay, we don't talk about Uriah the prophet very often. It's found in Jeremiah 26. He taught the same words as Jeremiah, and the king got mad at him, so he took off and ran to Egypt. They caught him, they extradited him, brought him back to Jerusalem, and King Jehoiakim killed him. So Jeremiah was delivered, Uriah was. Peter was delivered. Remember the story? Peter's in jail right there. An angel of the Lord comes. The shackles fall off, the doors open, and he walks out. So what about James? Was James delivered? No, he was arrested by King Herod, and King Herod had him beheaded. So, can we say that this is a personal promise that we didn't teach that, hey, if we do this, God's going to take care of us? No. Because we're pulling something out of its context and giving it meaning that doesn't necessarily exist. And now people see, they end up on this side. They end up on the side where they're not taken care of, and now they start to question their faith. Because we minimize this Old Testament story. Probably what they should have said is keep reading. Verse 18 in Daniel. They just said, God's going to take care of us. But then they say, but if not, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego realize that it might not go their way. But if not, he said, let it be known, O king, we will not serve your gods, nor will we worship the gold image which you have set up. We've got to kind of think about what God did, what he can do, and what he will do. And sometimes when we minimize that story and make it a very personal story, hell loses its meaning. So that's the fourth thing we've got to be careful of. So there's our historical psalms. This afternoon, we're going to go on the one that's in Greek. We're going to talk about Baal Peor. You know the story of Baal Peor. And I'm going to try not to do those four things that I just mentioned. I'm going to teach the story as it needs to be taught. But we need to be very careful of that. And think about how we teach Old Testament stories. Whether from the pulpit or from Bible studies or the way we teach our children, we need to be careful of that. I'll leave you with one final verse. Romans 15 and 4. For whatever things were written before were written for our learning, that we through patience and comfort of the Scriptures might have hope. When he says scriptures, what's he talking about? You ever thought about that? We like to think of scriptures as this is the scripture. Well, when Paul wrote that, New Testament wasn't written down yet. So when he's saying scriptures, he's actually meaning this part, the Old Testament. He says you've got to learn from the Old Testament, and it becomes our job to learn how to use the Old Testament most effectively in our teaching. So hopefully gave you something to think about this morning, and we'll continue with the story of Baal Peor this afternoon. We'd never like to close, though, without having a song of invitation. If we can help you in any way, we ask you to come forward now as we sing our song.